Today we're in Genesis chapter 42, and so when we were in chapter 41, we talked about how we talked about the moment, you know, when was Joseph's moment? When was he successful? At what moment did he fulfill what his life purpose came? And at that point, we had pointed out that there were many moments in his life that each one of these he had to make. But the very last moment was that moment when he says to his brothers, saying, I'm going to die, but God is going to be faithful to you, and he's going to take us back into the land of Canaan, take my bones with you when you go. And he made them promise that, and they did that. And that's the part that he's remembered for in Hebrews chapter 11, in the chapter of faith, the hall of faith. This is what he's remembered for, is that faith he had that God would call them back out of Egypt. But we're still in the middle of his life. And actually, as I was looking through here, there doesn't seem to be any really easy way to cover through all of this. I wanted to read through each one, but their stories are so intermingled. And so as we come to this moment where the brothers come and they bow down to Joseph, this is a moment where after a number of years, almost two decades, the brothers are coming, their lives and Joseph's life are coming back together again. And, you know, there's so much we can learn from running water. And one of the things we learn is that when you have two rivers and they separate ways and then they come back together, right where they come back together, there's usually turbulence. There's usually something rough right there. And so this has been decades old. This has been separated. So the last time Joseph saw his brothers was as he was walking away in shackles, having been sold into slavery. We're not told exactly who the ringleader was back then that suggested selling up. Well, Judah was one of them, but we're not told who was trying to kill him. But there seems to be, in the story that we see, that it seems that he's picking on Simeon quite a bit. And so there is some assumption that Simeon was one of the ringleaders. So what I want to do today is we're going to read through chapter 42. Parts of the story that we come across are just going to be there as we're reacquainting ourselves with where the brothers are, so that when we get to it next week, we can continue on with the story. But I'm looking for something specific here. And what I'm looking for specifically is, how is Joseph in his life, because he now has some sons that he's raising, he's married, he is second in command in Egypt, and how are the brothers, you know, they also have children, when they meet, what can we learn and glean from their what appears about their walk with the Lord? And so let's read in Genesis chapter 42, verse 1. When Jacob saw that there was grain in Egypt, Jacob said to his sons, "Why do you look at one another?" And he said, "Indeed, I have heard that there is grain in Egypt. Go down to that place and buy for us there, that we may live and not die." So Joseph's 10 brothers went down to buy grain in Egypt, but Jacob did not send Joseph's brother Benjamin with his brothers, for he said, lest some calamity befall him. By the way, Benjamin is an interesting character here, because we only see little bits and pieces of him. I get the feeling, and we'll see it when we get to Genesis 49, where Jacob is blessing the sons. His blessing for Benjamin sounds like Benjamin's a spoiled brat. Really, it does. And so I don't know exactly what's happening, but I mean, you know, here we have the brothers. They dare not touch Benjamin. So he's, you can't touch me type thing. The father honors, you know, holds Benjamin up just because he loved Rachel and Joseph. He's like almost not loving Benjamin for the sake of Benjamin, but he's loving Benjamin because of Rachel and Joseph. So this is, you know, so he keeps him back. But we'll look more at him in a couple of chapters when we are closing out each of the brothers' stories. But here he's held back lest some calamity befall him. So I can almost see this. You know, he's never been allowed to do anything dangerous lest some calamity befall him. So I'm picturing kind of a namby-pamby kid now, you know, who's always protected. But that's just me. We'll keep reading. Verse 5. And the sons of Israel went to buy grain among those who journeyed, for the famine was in the land of Canaan. Now Joseph was governor over the land, and it was he who sold to all the people of the land. And Joseph's brothers came and bowed down before him with their faces to the earth. And so they come, they bow down to him, and in that moment, as we talked about a couple weeks ago, this is his moment. This is what his dreams were about. He had, you know, here they come. They bow down. I have several artist renditions of what this might have looked like. The interesting thing for me is I'm not positive how the Egyptians bowed, but when they went in front of the Joseph in the chariot, they were supposed to cry out, bow the knee, bow the knee. And so they were bowing the knee. But here come the 10 brothers. They come in, and they bow down to this commander. And in that moment, Joseph flashes back to that time when the dream said this would happen. And so you have these different artist renditions of what that might have looked like. Genesis 42, verse 7 says, Joseph saw his brothers and recognized them, but he acted as a stranger to them and spoke roughly to them. Then he said to them, where do you come from? And they said, from the land of Canaan to buy food. And so notice how Joseph seems to on purpose be the rough water here. He on purpose, because what Joseph does, he has no idea. Who are my brothers today? Have they changed at all? Are they still who they were about 21 years ago? Are they still the same people? Have they responded well to life? Have they repented? He doesn't know. And so he's being very cautious and very careful of what he's doing. And so as he comes in, he speaks to them roughly, asks them where they come from. Verse 8. So Joseph recognized his brothers, but they did not recognize him. Then Joseph remembered the dreams which he had dreamed about them. And he said to them, you are spies. You have come to see the nakedness of the land. And so I can't help but think that as Joseph remembers back to 21 years ago when he came and shared his dreams and the words that came out of their mouths, I can't help but think that somehow the tone of voice that he's using is the same tone of voice they were using to him back then. And he's like, you're spies. You've come to see the nakedness of the land. So he's making an accusation against them. And this is interesting because when you want to know what is in someone, you've got to kind of shake them up a little bit to see what spills out. And so he's shaking them up a little bit. He's knocking them around to see what comes out from inside. But he's remembering the dreams. So again, I have some artist renditions of the dreams. Here was one where it has the sun, the moon, and the stars. Then there was another one here where he's got both the sheaves bowing down and the sun, moon, and stars. I don't know how stars bow down, the moon there is kind of an odd upside down thing because it's bowing. Here's another artist rendition of his Joseph's dreams, and so he immediately goes back to that moment when he have this dream. This is what he's remembering. Now, I don't know exactly what's happening with Joseph, but one of the things I've experienced personally is that when God first gives us something, so in this case it was a dream, that moment is usually what we would call a warm and fuzzy moment. Like it's something deep. It's something that shows us the deep love of God for us. It's something that convinces us that the creator of the heavens and the earth actually knows us and cares about us. And so that moment becomes very special when we have this sense that God is calling us or is setting us apart for something. And so I'm thinking that Joseph is getting something of that. That's what he remembers. Now, if we remember, you follow Joseph's storyline down, and there were many, many times when he had every reason to complain, and yet he came out faithful every single time. He came out, he was faithful. And so I just really want to know what Joseph was thinking right now. Is he thinking, I'm going to call in the army and chop their heads off? Like, I'm going to make them slaves for life? What is he thinking? Is he in this moment also being so faithful to God that he is having love and compassion and mercy on his brothers immediately that he sees them? Or is this a battle? Because I have been in this situation myself where I knew someone had wronged me, and then I was knew that we were going to be coming together again for something, and I had to really wrestle to forgive them, to be kind to them when I saw them again, to not bring up the old things. So I don't know what Joseph is dealing with. He's kind of masked. He's speaking through an interpreter to them. He recognized his brothers, but they did not recognize him. Verse 9, then Joseph remembered the dreams which he had dreamed about them and said to them, you are spies. You have come to see the nakedness of the land. And they said to him, no, my lord, but your servants have come to buy food. So in one sense, he's making them really grovel here. Verse 11, we're all one man's sons. We're honest men. All right, so what do you think Joseph thought when they said that? We're honest men. Oh, you are you? You never lie, right? You would never deceive anyone, would you? What does Joseph think when they say we're honest men? Because I know what I think when they say it. I'm like, y'all are a bunch of liars. Y'all agree together to lie. You guys aren't honest men. And yet, that's what they identify as. We are honest men. Your servants are not spies. But he said to them, no, but you have come to see the nakedness of the land. He's pushing them hard. Verse 13, and they said, your servants are 12 brothers. This is amazing to me. There's 10 of them there. But they say, we are 12. So they identify as 12 brothers, even though they sold one of themselves into slavery, and Benjamin's still at home. So they say, you know, anyone can count. 1, 2, 3, how many? Oh, there's only 10 of you. Where are the other two? But he says, we're 12, is what they say. The sons of one man in the land of Canaan, and in fact, the youngest is with our father today, and one is no more. They literally are reporting what Jacob told them. Like when Jacob saw the garment, he said, my son is no more. And so that's what they're going with. That's their talking point that they have adopted. Verse 14, but Joseph said to them, it is as I spoke to you, saying, you are spies. In this manner you shall be tested. By the life of Pharaoh, you shall not leave this place unless your youngest brother comes here. And so now we're seeing a test. Joseph knows his father well enough. He knows Benjamin. He knows the situation. And he's bringing on a test. But before we go on in the story, I want to stop and pull back. Hold on. Let's read a few more verses because I got them in here. Send one of you. Let him bring your brother, and you shall be kept in prison that your words may be tested to see whether there's any truth in you or else. By the life of Pharaoh, surely you are spies. So he put them all together in prison for 3 days. And so verse 18, then Joseph said to them the third day, do this and live, for I fear God. Notice how he was using the, said by Pharaoh. He's using an Egyptian term first. And then he comes back and says, but I fear God. If you are honest men, let one of your brothers be confined to your prison. So it's changed. Originally said, let's send one of your brothers back. And now it says, all of you go back except for one. But you go and carry grain for the famine of your houses and bring your youngest brother to me so your words will be verified and you shall not die. And they did so. And then, so then the next section starts explaining how they did it. But I wanted to stop for just a moment. This is the timeline of the lives. And so what I'm looking at specifically here is when Joseph was born. And look at this. This is when, that's the life of Isaac. When Isaac died, Joseph was 29 years old, according to the numberings, when Isaac died. So, you know, usually we read, because we're reading through and we see back in the end of chapter 31, I think that is, 30, somewhere back in the 30s, 35. End of chapter 35, it says Jacob, you know, Isaac breathed his last and he died and was gathered to his people. But when you look at all the numbers, you see that Isaac was still alive when Joseph was sold into Egypt. That's just an interesting bit of, and so if you look at the dates, so these are the flood, you have the creation year, so the years from creation, as best as we can calculate, there's a year or two error margin in those numbers. And then the flood years, so Isaac lived from 2111 to 2291, and then Jacob lived from 2171 to 2318. So see how it's, and so then we have Joseph. He lived from 2262 to 2372. And so if you look at the dates, 2291 is when Isaac died, 2262 is when Joseph was born. And so Joseph was 29 years old when Isaac died. That means that Joseph would have still been in prison in Egypt when Isaac died. And so Joseph would have known his grandfather Isaac. The other brothers would have known too. So this is part of what was happening when the two lives were separated while Joseph was down in Egypt. The brothers were at home. They've been going on with the livelihood of taking care of the sheep and the livestock. At some point, Isaac died. And so we know that Isaac had inherited quite a bit of stuff from Abraham. And so now I'm not sure what happened with all those things. We'll look at the numbers of people coming into Egypt next, I think it's next week or the week after. But we have the big inheritance that came from Abraham to Isaac, and then Jacob comes into Egypt, and it doesn't count his servants when he comes into Egypt. So I don't know what happened. I don't know if the servants all were sent back to their own places. I don't know if this, what happened with the servants. But there is a lot of transition seems to be happening while Joseph is sitting in prison. Except we know that Joseph was being faithful. He wasn't just sitting in prison. He was being faithful all the way through. He was serving. And so age 30, Joseph is pulled up out of the prison, brought before Pharaoh. And now we're into the first year of the famine, so we're 8 years later. So Joseph is about 38 years old right now. And he was 17 when he came out of Canaan, when he was sold into slavery. And so we have this time period, 21 years has gone by. A lot has changed, but it seems that the brothers haven't really changed. Like, life stuff has happened and changed, but the brothers, look at what we come to next here. Genesis 42, verse 21. This is what they say. They're put into prison, and they're being told, leave one of your brothers here. Genesis 42, verse 21. Then they said to one another, we are truly guilty concerning our brother. For we saw the anguish of his soul when he pleaded with us, and we would not hear. Therefore, this distress has come upon us. 21 years ago, they did something. They're now down in Egypt, and they're running into some hardship, and the first thought is, it's because of what we did to our brother. And then look what keeps happening. Verse 22, and Reuben answered them, saying, did I not speak to you, saying, do not sin against the boy, and you would not listen? Therefore, behold, his blood is now required of us. But they did not know that Joseph understood them, for he spoke to them through an interpreter. Their consciences have been guilty for 21 years. Just about everything that comes down the pike that is a problem, they immediately say, we're getting this because of what we did. And every time they bring it up, what does Reuben say? I tried to tell you guys not to do this, and you just did it. Anyway, so Reuben thinks he's being a leader. He's the firstborn, right? So he should be the leader. But every single time, he comes up with this. Every time they bring up that, he brings up this. He's like, I tried to tell you all. And so they still haven't moved on. It's like it just happened. They're still standing there going, we were wrong. We shouldn't have done that. Now this stuff is happening to us. And Reuben's like, I told you all you shouldn't do it. And so I bet you this conversation has happened every year, maybe every month, for 21 years. Because it's the first thing that shows up when they get in this trouble. And so we see with these brothers, they've got this issue. And so verse 24, and he turned himself away from them and wept. So I'm not sure what he's weeping about. Joseph goes and he hears what they say. He goes away, he weeps. Is he weeping because they're still the same? Is he weeping because when they brought it up, it brought everything fresh to him and he remembered his own grief from that day, seeing it from his perspective? What's happening? I don't know. But Joseph is weeping. Then he returned to them again and talked with them, and he took Simeon from them and bound him before their eyes. This is one of the reasons why I think Simeon must have played a big part in the earlier drama, because Joseph picks on him, not just like shuttles him away, but he like binds him before their eyes and puts him in prison. Verse 25, then Joseph gave a command to fill their sacks with grain, to restore every man's money to his sack, and to give them provisions for the journey. Thus he did for them. So they loaded their donkeys with the grain and departed from there. But as one of them opened his sack to give his donkey feed at the encampment, he saw his money, and there it was in the mouth of his sack. So he said to his brothers, my money has been restored, and there it is in my sack. Then their hearts failed them, and they were afraid, saying to one another, what is this that God has done to us? They're just sure that God is punishing them, because they have a guilty conscience. Verse 29, then they went to Jacob, their father, in the land of Canaan, and told him all that had happened to them, saying, The man who is the Lord of the land, that's Joseph, spoke roughly to us and took us for spies of the country. But we said to him, we are honest men, we are not spies. We are 12 brothers, sons of our father. One is no more, and the youngest is with our father this day in the land of Canaan. How often do you think they've said this thing about one is no more? Because if they were honest, we'd be like, we sold one into slavery and the other one's still at home. But they're not saying that part. They're just, one is no more. That's the part that Jacob says. So they keep repeating that line back. Verse 33, then the man, the lord of the country, said to us, by this I will know that you are honest men. Leave one of your brothers here with me. Take food for the famine of your households and be gone. And bring your youngest brother to me, so I shall know that you are not spies, but that you are honest men. I will grant your brother to you, and you may trade in the land. Then it happened, as they emptied their sacks, that surprisingly each man's bundle of money was in his sack, and when they and their father saw the bundles of money, they were afraid. And Jacob, their father, said to them, you have bereaved me. Joseph is no more, Simeon is no more, and you want to take Benjamin. All these things are against me. Then Reuben spoke to his father, saying, kill my two sons if I do not bring him back to you. Put him in my hands, and I will bring him back to you. But he said, my son shall not go down with you, for his brother is dead, and he is left alone. If any calamity should befall him along the way in which you go, then you would bring down my gray hair with sorrow to the grave. And so we see, this is the first time we've seen Jacob in a while. Jacob seems to still be very much, you know, it's only been, 9 years ago that Jacob's father died? But he's actually thinking in terms of his Joseph more than his own father. Like he's bereaved of Joseph. And look at what Reuben comes up with as the firstborn. Reuben says, hey, look, if, and so think of it in these terms. Reuben says to Jacob, if your son, anything happens to your son, then, and you will, and you know, something bad happens to him, then we'll kill two of your grandsons. You know, this will be great. Then we'll have three bereavements. I mean, I don't know what Reuben's even thinking. I don't know if he is thinking, but this is what he comes up with as a solution. This is my promise. And so I'm like, what is Reuben thinking? I mean, Jacob doesn't even give him the time of day on it. Like he doesn't consider it. It's stupid. But this is where Reuben is. And so we find Reuben, when we get to the end of it, when Jacob is blessing him at the end of his life, he says, Reuben, you are my firstborn. You're the, you know, the pride, all this other stuff. But you are as fickle as the wind. You're uncertain. You're unsteady. You're basically worthless. And so we see this coming up in Reuben's life. He really isn't a leader. He's the firstborn, but he's not leading. He says stupid things, and he's not leading. You know, a leader would have said back when he first discovered that Joseph was sold into slavery, he said, you know what, guys? This is not going to work. Get your guns. We're going after him. And get him back. That's what a leader would have done. Might have of his own gone after them and brought, said, look, here's the money. I need that one back. That's what a leader would have done. But Reuben was not a leader. It's hard being 1 year old. So this is what has been happening. We have this situation, when we get the glimpses of who they are, it seems that Joseph has matured a lot during this time, but the brothers don't seem to have moved on from that day. And so, you know, if we look back in Genesis 34, this was the end of Genesis 34. This was after Simeon and Levi had gone out and had killed all those people in defense of Dinah. Look what they say. Jacob says to Simeon and Levi, you have troubled me by making me obnoxious among the inhabitants of the land. And so instead of Simeon and Levi saying, oh, you know what, we probably were acting rashly and did something stupid, what they say, verse 31, but they said, should he treat our sister like a harlot? And so they're repeating, and I can imagine whenever this scenario comes up, that becomes their talking point for this. And what the pattern that we see, Genesis 42, verse 21, what we just read a minute ago, they said to one another, we are truly guilty concerning our brother, for we saw the anguish of his soul when he pleaded with us, and we would not hear. Therefore, this distress has come upon us. And then Reuben makes his excuse. The thing with this is I feel like they have never come out before God and man and said, we did wrong. They have only always among themselves bickered and said, we were wrong. We shouldn't have done that. Why did we do that? That was horrible. Now look what's happening to us. And it's still themselves they're worried about. They're still not feeling sorry for Joseph as much as they're feeling sorry for themselves because God is not blessing them, is what they're feeling. If we look at back in Genesis 37, verse 8, his brothers said to him, "Shall you indeed reign over us, or shall you indeed have dominion over us?" So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. One of the things about being in a family is when one of your siblings has something good happen for them, you don't just cut them down. We are generally glad because it's good for the whole family when one of us is successful. And so just because one of the brothers is successful doesn't mean that any of the others can't be successful. And so in a good family relationship where there's love and compassion between the siblings, we rejoice with one another when something good happens to one of the siblings. We're glad for them because it's not that we're like, oh, so now all the good in the world has happened to you. There's no good left for me. That's not the way it works. When we see a blessing or something good happening to the sibling, it gives us hope that maybe that God will also bless us if we're faithful. We don't just immediately say, oh, well, now you're hogging all the good. You know, it doesn't. And yet this is what it seems that they're doing. They're looking at him going, well, you think God's talking to you. And they're not responding well. So we see this consistency throughout their life of they're selfish, they're self-centered. They don't get it of what God is trying to do. And so it's neat. I mean, if you keep reading back in Genesis 37, when the dreams first came, when they saw him afar off, even before he came near them, they conspired against him to kill him. Then they said to one another, "Look, this dreamer is coming. Come, therefore, let us now kill him and cast him into some pit, and we shall say some wild beast has devoured him. We shall see what will become of his dreams." But Reuben heard it, and he delivered him out of their hands and said, "Let us not kill him." And Reuben said to them, "Shed no blood, but cast him into this pit which is in the wilderness, and do not lay a hand on him, that he might deliver him out of their hands and bring him back to his father." So Reuben had a good impulse and good. He started out good here in this scenario. Verse 23, "So it came to pass when Joseph had come to his brothers that they stripped Joseph of his tunic, the tunic of many colors that was on him. Then they took him and cast him into a pit, and the pit was empty. There was no water in it. And they sat down to eat a meal. Then they lifted their eyes and looked, and there was a company of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels, bearing spices, balm, and myrrh, on their way to carry them down to Egypt. So Judah said to his brothers, 'What profit is there if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother and our flesh.' And his brothers listened." And so Judah, at this point, I don't know what's happening in the camp that makes this one be a better idea. But his brothers listen to Judah, and maybe they're still wanting to kill him. But Judah says, "Let's sell him." So they agree. Now, what we see in the life of Judah is that when you squeeze him into the corner, all the way back, he will often come up with he'll do the right thing. But first, he will try a whole bunch of other things. We get to look at the life of Judah coming up soon because there's a lot written about him here. His first response isn't usually the right one. But when you give him a little bit of time, he'll kind of come up with the right response and he'll do the right thing. So his brothers are listening to him, and you'll see that a lot with him, with Judah, is his brothers listen to Judah much more than they listen to Reuben or any of the others. He's becoming the leader, and he is the fourthborn, not the firstborn. So the Midianite traders passed by, so the brothers pulled Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit, sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver, and they took Joseph to Egypt. Then Reuben returned to the pit. Indeed, Joseph was not in the pit, and he tore his clothes, and he returned to his brothers and said, "The lad is no more, and I, where shall I go?" So they took Joseph's tunic, killed a kid of the goats, and dipped the tunic in the blood. Then they sent the tunic of many colors, and they brought it to their father and said, "We have found this. Do you know where it is? Whether it is your son's tunic or not?" And he recognized it and said, "It is my son's tunic. A wild beast has devoured him. Without doubt, Joseph is torn in pieces." Then Jacob tore his clothes and put sackcloth on his waist and mourned for his son many days. And his sons and all his sons and all his daughters arose to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. And he said, "For I shall go down into the grave to my son in mourning." Thus his father wept for him. And now the Midianites had sold him to Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh and captain of the guard. And so this is back to what was happening. This is what Joseph immediately thinks of when the brothers show up, they bow down. He goes back to this time period, to what's happening here. The brothers are thinking about this time. But you know, as we go back and we look at let's look at one more scripture. You know, on Jacob's deathbed, after Jacob dies and they bury him, then in Genesis 50, verse 15, when Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, perhaps Joseph will hate us and may actually repay us for all the evil which we did to him. So they sent messengers to Joseph. They sent messengers to their brother, saying, before your father died, he commanded, saying, thus you shall say to Joseph, I beg you, please forgive the trespass of your brothers and their sin, for they did evil to you. Now please forgive the trespass of the servants of the God of your father. And Joseph wept when they spoke to him. Okay, so first of all, what's wrong with coming directly to your brother saying, we were wrong. We should not have done this thing. But they come. They don't even say we were wrong. They say, our father told us to tell you that we had done wrong. They were still, even in this, only thinking of their own skins, because they're thinking he's big in command. He could do something bad to us. And so even now, they're not saying we were wrong. They're saying, our father said we should tell you that, you know, we're sorry, basically. And so it's not even, there's nothing still coming from the depths of their heart. There is still no sense of full repentance coming from them, of owning it. Joseph has said it multiple times. So because now his brothers actually come and fall down before his face, they say, behold, we are your servants. This is the closest thing we've come to a real confession from them. Verse 19, Joseph said to them, do not be afraid, for am I in the place of God? Joseph is operating on a whole different plane than they are. Verse 20, but as for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good. Joseph has told this to them before. We'll see it next in chapter 43. God meant it for good in order to bring it about as it is this day to save many people alive. Now, therefore, do not be afraid. I will provide for you and your little ones. And he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. And so we have this amazing picture that all the way through their life, this is what they're thinking about, but they've never clear it. They never get it taken care of. They have been stuck their whole life on this. And there are some things in your life that you may be stuck on, that certain things happen and you're immediately back there. And there are two sides of this. Sometimes you are the victim and sometimes you are the one who did wrong. But when you're brought back into that moment, you have several options. One is immediately is to always say, well, how can I preserve myself in this moment and try to protect yourself and try to like defend yourself and say, well, I did right and this is, you know, or maybe I was wrong, but you know, whatever. And you try to make, or you can say, I was wrong. And you can deal with it to the extent that the next time you come around and you get to that spot, it's not the first thing that comes back. Because the love of God can cleanse us from all unrighteousness. We don't have to walk with the guilt of the past on us. That's the one side. We don't have to carry the guilt all the way to the end, always trying to find a way to alleviate the burden of it. We can actually be cleared of it. The second side is if you're the victim, if the wrongdoing was done to you, you don't have to always walk around with the wound hanging out and bleeding. You can actually find healing. You can actually forgive and recognize that no matter what the enemy throws at you, how bad it destroys to destroy your life, there is a God in heaven who will transform it and change it and bring healing. And you can get to the point of healing so that when you, because this is what's happening to Joseph, the brothers are coming up and they keep saying this thing and Joseph is ministering to the ones who hurt him. They are saying, how can we keep him from hurting us? And he's saying, listen, God knew what was happening. He transformed it. He used it. You meant it for evil. God used it for good. He meant it for good. And Joseph spoke kindly to them. So for Joseph to speak kindly to them, this means that Joseph is able to think about his brothers kindly. He is not, his first response isn't just like, well, let's rattle this saber and let's see if we can scare them. He has moved on to this point. And so I'm not sure where he is back here in chapter 42 when he first sees his brother. I'm not sure what's happening to him because we see him consistently as he's dealing with his brothers. He consistently weeps. He is moved deeply emotionally by their responses and the things they say and the things they do. There's something going on that is causing Joseph to weep, and I don't think it's just the pain of rejection from 20 years ago. I think there's something deeper here, because for Joseph, the reality of God is so big and so real. And when he hears his brothers talking and bickering, he realizes God is not real to them. They're not experiencing God the way they could be. They're not receiving grace. They're not receiving mercy. They're struggling in this, and they've been here for decades. Now, some of these older brothers, this is the way they learned their Christianity, so to speak, from their father. Because when they were growing up, the way Jacob was dealing with God was devious. The way Jacob kept thinking, well, I'm going to do this and this, and I'm going to make it happen. And later we see Jacob telling his wives, you know what? It was God all along that was the blessing. It wasn't my own strength. But the older brothers had already learned their worldview of God from their father, Jacob. And so even though Jacob recognized some of it, we see that Jacob is not a perfect father. He's not a perfect leader. But something happened to Joseph. You see, God took Joseph out of this area. If Joseph would have just stayed at home and always been the favored son and always had his brothers mad at him, this would have been decades of family infighting and feuding. But God took Joseph out of that, brought him to a completely different environment, put him into a very difficult place, and showed himself real to Joseph. And Joseph responded to God. Joseph didn't respond to being thrown into jail. Joseph wasn't angry at Potiphar for many days. We don't read any of that here. We don't see him being upset, but every time when he has a chance, he immediately points people back to God. He says, God is the one who interprets dreams. God is the one who meant this for good. God is the one. And so it seems that Joseph's heart and his thought are always pointing us back to God. He's saying, God is doing something here. Look at what he's doing. And so Joseph is walking in peace, but his brothers are walking in the pain and in the guilt of their own things. And so as I look at these two parallels, because we're going to come back, what's amazing is as we read back, you know, Stephen's speech in Acts, Psalm 78, several other places refer back to these fathers, the forefathers of Israel. And you stop and you think, God took these 12 brothers, each with their challenges and problems, and he turned them into this nation that was to go by his name. And God used them and didn't just, because he could have, he had every reason at various times to say, well, I don't want that one, get him out of the way. And in fact, remember that time with Moses, where he said, okay, Moses, stand back, I want to destroy all of them because they're so wicked. And Moses says, no, Lord, you have to be true to yourself. This is the only person we can say that to. For God to be true to himself, because in the deepest depths of who God is, he is merciful, he is kind, he is just. And yes, he is the judge of the whole earth. But Moses said, you are a merciful God. You are the God of second chances. Let them go. Let's do this one more time. And God said, yes, that's the heart that I want to see in my servant. And so we see this already here. Some of them are responding to God. God is using all of them. We have the same option in our life. God is going to use you, whether you like it or not. You will either be the one operating in selfishness, trying to protect yourself, trying to put yourself forward, and you will be the brothers that get to put Joseph in the pit and then sell him into slavery, or you will be the one that responds correctly to God. And no matter what happens to you, you will always turn back to the Lord and allow him to transform it. Those are our options, because God is going to use us either willingly. This has got to be the most frustrating thing for Satan, is that no matter what he does, God uses it and transforms it. And so he's like, I have this great idea. I'm going to take this corrupt guy and turn this and do this and do all this stuff. And God's like, okay, watch this. And out of this comes a growth of the church. Look at the church in China today. It has exploded. Not a soft church, not a church that is interested in their own selfish gains, but a church that is willing to die for the confession of Jesus Christ. And this was something that the enemy meant for evil, and God turned it into good. In fact, I loved it because the Time magazine editor that went into China to do some other stories was so intrigued by it, by the secret church, that he went back now about 10 years ago, David Akeman, and he wrote the whole book, going back and saying, well, how is it that Jesus is so alive in Beijing? How is the house church so big when they've done so much to kill the church? How is it still alive? Not just alive, but growing and thriving and sending out missionaries, sometimes to the United States. But the church in China is growing. And so here was a picture. The enemy meant it for evil, and God said, watch this. Because God is able to take anything and turn it around into something beautiful for his kingdom. And I believe that is part of what we'll be doing in eternity, is we'll be able, it'll be, you know, at creation, God created all of this stuff, and Adam and Eve would come walk with him in the cool of the day. And I don't know, but I picture it was kind of like this. They'd be walking along, and they would see something beautiful, and God would say, hey, Adam, check this out. Isn't that beautiful? And Adam's like, wow, God, you are amazing. That's amazing. It's beautiful. And so that was part of the fellowship that I imagine they were having. Well, that's what I imagine in eternity. One of the things that will be happening is God will say, hey, I want to show you something. Remember this? You're like, oh, yes, I remember that. That was rough. I want to show you. And he shows you the beauty of what he has done over and over again throughout history. The beauty that is a spiritual beauty that is so much bigger and deeper than the temporary pain and agony that we might have been going through. And so we're right in the middle of the story with Joseph and his brothers. There's a lot other things that we'll get to see as the two come together here in the next couple chapters. But the part that really encouraged me in looking at Genesis 42 was that it was so clear there are two ways. One is the path that is lit by selfishness, is everything is how am I going to survive, how am I going to do, and it's a hard, hard road. And then there's this other road that from the outside looks like prison and horrible things, being sold into slavery, but because of a right response to God, it's a beautiful, beautiful road. And Joseph becomes this picture of Jesus. Here comes Jesus, the creator of the universe, comes down into Bethlehem as a crying baby. He has to run for his life when he's just an infant. And comes around, he grows up in this place that is under political, they're not free. They're in bondage to Rome. And he grows up and he is in every way subject to the things that we as people have to deal with. He is a man. And you say, what is the creator of the universe down here for? Why is the creator, and you look at Joseph and say, wait a minute, Joseph is going to be the one that is going to save all of Israel? What's he doing in prison? What's he doing down there? And like one of the Amish ministers that I grew up with used to say, he was probably having to clean the toilets down there. And so it's very, I don't know what you did when you served in prison, but I can't imagine that it was glamorous. So it had to have been kind of rough. So what is he doing? If this is the one that God has chosen to rescue his people and get them through this famine, what's he doing in prison? If Jesus Christ, the creator of the universe, if he is the one that is going to save all mankind and bring us up to him in glory, what's he doing walking the dusty roads of Galilee? But there he is. And we see that moment when the enemy comes in. He says, we're going to kill that one. Crucify him, crucify him. And they put him on the cross. And 3 days later, he rises again. And all of creation rejoices because our redemption draws near. This is where our salvation is coming from. It's through Jesus, through the death, the burial, the resurrection. And sure, he went through that time of where he looked just like a man. And we looked at it and said, what are you doing? We don't get it. Why are you letting them beat you? Why are you allowing the Roman soldiers to mock you? Because it wasn't about that. They meant it for evil. God meant it for good. This is the story of Joseph. This is what we get. And so for you, for me, let us be the ones who choose not in selfishness to try to make it best for ourselves, but let us look unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, and say, Lord, what is it you're trying to do? Would you take my circumstances? Would you take my trials? Would you take my sufferings? Would you take all of these things that seem so big to me right now? I just bring them to the cross and I give them to you. Would you transform them for your glory, for your honor? And let me choose peace. When those around me are choosing to, are bickering among themselves and are trying to explain why they did the right thing and whatever, let me just choose the peace of the living God in the middle of this. And that's the path we want to, the path that Joseph took, the path that might go through prison, but it ends up not just being blessed here on earth the way Joseph was, but it ends up with the favor of the Most High on us. That's what we want. So let's pray, and then we'll look at the rest of this in the coming weeks. Father, I thank you so much for your love and your compassion to us. Lord, I thank you that even when Jesus was on earth, he kept saying things that made no sense, like he that keeps his life will lose it, and he who loses his life for my sake in the Gospels will keep it. Father, you meant that. You have turned the economy of this world that has been sold under sin, you've turned it upside down, and you've made it exactly the opposite of what we would think. And you've given us hope. And so, Father, we come to you. We thank you for that hope. And Lord, I pray for each of us in here, Father, as we are facing the trials that come to us just because we live in a fallen world, that we would be able to turn our eyes to Jesus, that we'd be able to roll our burdens over to you and to allow you to transform it, even if it means suffering for a season, that we would do it with joy and with confidence that there is a God in heaven who knows, who cares, who is not freaking out, but that you know what's happening and you are transforming it. You're working in our lives even now, things that we cannot see or understand. Father, thank you for your great love to us. Thank you for not leaving us just stuck in the pit, but redeeming it and pulling us out and transforming it. We're so grateful, Father. Lord, I pray in Jesus' name, amen.